Thank you. Our next case is A21-1233, Lang versus Bjorklund et al. As all parties are aware, this is a Zoom argument and it is being recorded. However, our rules prohibit anyone else from recording it, either attorneys, parties, or someone who's just watching. Appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. The respondent will have 15 minutes. And finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So whenever counsel for the appellant is ready, just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice and you may begin. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Mahoney and I represent the appellant, James Lang. And as you can hear, I'm suffering from a serious cold. And my doctors told me I can't operate heavy equipment, but he didn't say I couldn't appear before the court. So just bear with me on a bit on the presentation in terms of my voice. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, sir. Okay. We can. And I can appreciate your difficulties, and we appreciate your willingness to continue no matter what.
Thank you. I want to concentrate on three matters here, which we submit requires a reversal of the trial court. The matter was presented in an amended complaint, and it was the trial court dismissed the amended complaint. Arguments were presented as if it was a summary judgment, and then the court considered it under a dismissal. The standards are well understood and well applied, that the well-pled allegations in the amended complaint are deemed true. The first error is the court failed to consider those elements. The court has scant, if any, reference at all to the amended complaint. I think it's because the history was it was first presented to the court with the wrong complaint, just the basic complaint. So the first element of the argument for reversal is if this complaint is considered the way it should have been under Rule 12, is the court reads the four corners of the complaint, test those complaint under our Supreme Court Hansen decision, and is the elements of the claim sufficient to pass that minimal standard?
And so, Mr. Mahoney, is that the court should look at that complaint to the exclusion of any other complaints?
Yes. If the court wants
what case, to... What case says that?
Well, I don't know of any case anywhere that provides that a court can ignore the amended complaint and can reach back into another complaint and take an allegation from the complaint, establish that allegation as being true because it's supposedly an admission. But I could not find any decision anywhere that under Rule 12, ignore the amended complaint, go find something that's like two lines from a different complaint, and then ignore the standard for Rule 12, which requires that the court apply any reasonable inference that comes from anything that's considered by the court. So the four yes, Judge.
I think I understand the argument you're making. And let me confirm that the motion was before the court for either dismissal under Rule 12 or summary judgment. So the parties prepared, and I see your briefs submitted, summary judgment arguments and a summary judgment record. The district court decided to do this as a Rule 12, not as summary judgment. If the district court had said, I'm going to treat this as summary judgment, would we be as concerned about the district court looking at this other complaint? Because then the district court could look beyond the four corners of the complaint in the 2020 action?
Not as much, Judge. I think that when facts are presented that can be
argued, how about not at all?
Yeah. I let me take yes with that. I should have just accept yes.
There you go. Always a pleasure to see you, Mr. Mahoney. You actually know how to take a hint.
Let me ask this.
I've been accused otherwise.
In looking at this, here's the question I'm asking myself, and maybe you can address this for me. I kind of see your point that the way the judge explained the decision, it doesn't really look like a Rule 12 decision because it's not kind of strict compliance with those requirements. And we don't have a case that talks about looking at some other complaint. But what I ask myself is, is that error harmless if in fact the motion was also there on summary judgment? This other complaint is part of the summary judgment record, and a summary judgment determination is de novo. So in other words, you know, is there a case where, you know, we may have said the district court screwed up, shouldn't have done this as Rule 12, should have done it as summary judgment. Well, then what? Do we send it back or do we just say de novo? Well, we can look at this and see on a de novo standard that summary judgment will be warranted here.
I think the answer to the question is you send it back, because if we were arguing about a summary judgment standard, I submit it's clear that there are material facts that are in dispute.
What would those be?
Well, we provided them as you were referencing back to, right. I referenced there's an affidavit provided by Mr. Lang that has, I think, 65 specific facts that are deemed to be disputed with respect to the allegations that are submitted as being contrary.
But now, as I understand it, you know, he's in the 2020 case pleading that, well, I know the bank had the property, but I thought it was a bail and then I thought it was for safekeeping. But then he's got this other 2018 complaint in which he makes statements that indicate he knew the bank had the property and he was never going to get it back.
No, and as I... categorically, no.
Okay.
That is fundamentally not true. Mr. Lang's statements in the underlying case, which get refined in the amended complaint. The amended complaint states, Mr. Lang was told in 2012, specifically by Mr. Cross, that his property was being held by the bank, safe kept by the bank, and Mr. Lang would be notified if for any reason they were going to do anything with it. Now, you compare those words from the 2020, go back to 2018, Mr. Lang makes a statement that he understood the bank had possession of his property, which I submit is not inconsistent with a bailment.
But I thought the district court cited a line that said more like the bank could do with it what it wanted.
That may be what the court stated, but that's not what the complaint states.
The amended complaint, if I may ask, the amended complaint is only in the second action. The first action in 2018 was never amended.
No, it was. There's a second amended complaint in the 2018, the first action.
Okay, so we're looking at, the district court was looking at amended complaints in both actions, or?
I have no idea. The sequence of events was there was a motion for dismissal or summary judgment. The bank submitted the complaint, which was not the operative complaint, in the 2020 action. There was an amended complaint. That didn't go to the court for the court's consideration. In the reply, I don't mean to refer Mr. Scott to your client pejoratively as the bank, but Mr. Scott's client, Flagship Bank, submitted the amended complaint after the motion had been presented, after we responded, and it was in the reply.
Counsel,
I'm sorry. I just think I need to know when you say amended complaint, let's always attach a year to it, because I'm having...
Yes.
I'm sure. Not understanding complaint, amended complaint. Okay.
Because in the briefing too, when people talk about, the current act, it's like, just give us the year. Is it 2018, 2020?
I'm looking at
the language that the district court quoted from the second amended complaint in the 28 action, which she attributes to your client. Lang did not learn the bank had foreclosed on Lang's Little Pine and Big Sandy property until about 2012, when Lang learned that the bank had taken everything. By December 2013, Lang was not able to pay to litigate his claims. Lang lost all his property to the bank, and the bank had taken all of Lang's equipment, so he could not work at building cabins. I mean, that doesn't really say the bank's got the property for safe keeping. I mean, that was the district court's reasoning. Like, that sounds like he was on notice on those dates that the bank took his property and he wasn't getting it back. Is that not what that complaint says?
That is not what the complaint says. What the complaint says is the first part is a real estate foreclosure description. There were four properties in the 2018 complaint related to real estate. Mr. Lang learned late in the process that his real estate had been foreclosed and, quote unquote, the bank had taken everything because the sequence was three foreclosures by notice, followed by a foreclosure by action. That's when he noticed the bank had taken the real estate. The second part is Lang learned that the bank had taken his property, which he could not use to be able to build the cabins.
Isn't he on notice then that he has a potential claim against the bank to get his property back?
Well, there's a question about what does he know about the bank having the property? And then you go to the 2020 complaint.
But here's the thing. As I understand it, all we're looking at is when does the claim accrue such that the statute of limitations kicks in? We're not having like an on the merits decision about what was his understanding. It's, was there enough evidence for the claim to accrue? That is, did he know that he might have a claim against the bank and he needed to act on it in 2018? I think that's all we're asking here.
And the answer to that.
In 2020, he claimed something different, but it sure looks like in 2018, according to his amended complaint, he had reason to believe he wasn't getting his property back from the bank, given that the bank had taken all of it pursuant to a foreclosure and that he didn't have access it to do his construction work.
Have to separate those in two parts. Real estate, yes. Personal property, no. Mr. Lang's argument, and I think it's logical, is that the bank had possession of it. And so Mr. Lang has to make a determination of what's the bank going to do with it. The 2020 action, which is all about a bailment, is that Mr. Lang did investigate. He investigated the location of his property and was
Can I ask, what did the bank do with the property ultimately?
They sold some of it and some of it disappeared.
Okay, what did they do with the proceeds of the sale?
Kept it.
Was that to pay off the debt?
It didn't pay off anything. They just kept it. And we, by the way, just an aside, is we had a trial, jury trial, and my submission to you is that the jury found that the bank converted Mr. Lang's equipment and found that the bank was civilly liable for civil theft on that equipment. So they
That in the record?
No.
For us?
Okay. It is not in the record before you.
But, and following up on Judge Larkin's excellent point, I mean, as to when banks are not storage companies. I mean, they're banks. They don't want your stuff because your stuff either isn't worth anything or they got to pay somebody to store it or blah, blah, blah. I mean, banks, the last thing they want to do is deal with your property. So I'm having a personal property. I'm having a hard time understanding, again, following up on Judge Larkin's point. I mean, if the bank's keeping his property for several years and in his mind, they're just being good corporate citizens, as we all know banks are. Every day of their lives, it seems to me the average person would call, where's the stuff? You still have it? I'd like to get some of my stuff. Why are we wrong, Mr. Mahoney?
You're not wrong. The focus of that is what did Mr. Lang do that was diligent with respect to looking for his property? And that's the fraudulent concealment argument. And in the fraudulent concealment argument, the judge identified the three elements that must be satisfied. And it's on page, it's the addendum, page 9. And each of those elements is satisfied by Mr. Lang's 2020 complaint, in which he lists specifically how he contacted the bank, what the bank told him, what he was diligent about looking out for, what he was told by both Mr. Bjorklund and others that his property was being safely kept. And so Mr. Lang sets out in paragraphs, I believe they're 35 through 60, specifically identifying the elements of fraudulent concealment, which the court never considered, never looked at them. And so you ask the question, all right, how would this man look for his equipment? He identifies it. There's no public notice of the sale. There's no place he could look to in the record to find his equipment. He's told specifically by a banker, we have it. He follows up with the banker saying they have it. Now that relates to the bank. The Bjorklund claim is Mr. Bjorklund, who was someone nobody knew had anything to do with this transaction doesn't show up in any record produced by anybody until 2019. So it's reasonable for Mr. Lange to look. He did look. He satisfies all the elements, Rule 12 pleading standards. He identified all the elements for fraudulent concealment, which the court ignored. So we believe that if you compare reasonable inferences, compare the words that are set forth and must be accepted as true, that Mr. Lange satisfied his requirements. And I see that my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Mahoney. You will have rebuttal. We'll now hear for counsel from Mr. Bjorklund et al.
Good morning, Your Honors. Opposing counsel, may it please the court. Jeffrey Scott on behalf of the respondents. Maybe I can just take a couple minutes to explain practically what's going on here. Your Honor asked about the trial. So Mr. Lange sued Flagship Bank, couple employees of Flagship Bank, and some other parties in December of 2018, arguing that personal property was taken from a cabin following a foreclosure. That case, after 2 years of litigation, after the deadline to add additional parties had passed, Mr. Lange just simply commenced a new action against a former, I believe, board member of the bank, Bjorklund, just sued out the same case, same personal property, same allegations, exact same subject matter. That case immediately got companioned by stipulation by the parties to Judge Miller. The first complaint in 2018 against, I'll call Landmark. Landmark is a bank acquired by Flagship. He amended that complaint twice. So we have three complaints in the 2018 action. And then in this-
May I interrupt for a moment, Mr. Scott? And yes. I hope this is okay, Presiding Judge. Mr. Mahoney, I don't see that you're muted, and maybe that would be a good idea during your, thanks.
Thank you, Judge.
So-
Still not muted.
Stop the clock, please. It's kind of the lower button on the left, generally, you know, on your computer. In the interim, please give Mr. Scott go back 45 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I proceed?
Just let's get the clock right. Just hold on. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. So when we talk about amended complaints, there was three complaints in the 2018 action. And then again, after the deadline to add additional parties, Mr. Lange just simply commences a new lawsuit and on the same day files a complaint and an amended complaint. So he files two complaints on the same day for the 2020 action. So we have five complaints. Now, the 2018 action went to a week-long jury trial on the first week of March of this year. I think Mr. Mahoney has asked for millions of dollars of damages. The jury awarded Mr. Lange $7,700. The case is over. That is the personal property, and that was the jury award. Now, this case involves the same personal property that already went to trial, and a verdict's already been rendered. So that's kind of the background. Now, when the judge...
Well, the case against the bank is over, and now there are claims that Mr. Lange is making against your client. And I guess the issue is, you know, different lawsuits, different clients, different theories. Why is Mr. Mahoney's client stuck with the allegations in the bank, any of the amended complaints, versus the allegations against Mr. Bjork, your client in this case? So why is he stuck?
Your Your Honor, if you look at page one of Mr. Lange's reply brief, you know, he alleges, Mr. Lange alleged he discovered the bank had his personal property in 2012. And really that's what this case is about. He's made those statements and allegations in numerous complaints that he knew in 2012 that his personal property was taken. And, you know, in the 2018 companion case, he says in March of 2012, Lange demanded he be told where his personal property is. He says in March 2012, Cross, who is a bank employee, told Lange the bank had the right to keep his personal property. So that's when the statute of limitations started, is in 2012. That's when the clock began. And
so are you reading from his complaint or his reply brief?
The first statement I read was from page one of his reply brief. And then those follow-up statements are from the second amended complaint, which is the final complaint in the 2018 action.
And what paragraph?
That's the second amended complaint in the 2018 action.
Right, but the statement you read is from what paragraph of the complaint?
Those are... I have that as it's doc number 77, and they are paragraphs 55, 57, and 69.
Okay. Thank you.
And then Lange makes a similar allegation in this 2020 complaint about knowing in 2012 that his personal property was taken. And again, that's what this is about. And Mr. Lange attempts to qualify that admission by saying, I didn't know until 2019 that the personal property was subsequently sold. But for purposes of not knowing enough to sue in a 6-year window, it doesn't matter what was later, whether or how that property was sold. He knew enough to try to get back his personal property and not wait 7 or 8 years to then learn more. So he's conflating the issue of what subsequently happened to the personal property to what he knew in 2012.
Mr. Scott, just to be clear for me, if the only thing looked at was the amended complaint in the 2020 action, the action before us, would a statute of limitation, dismissal on basis statute of limitations be appropriate? Or does, yes. Did the... It would, just on the face of the Second Amendment complaint in this action alone.
Yes, Your Honor. He makes
how,
the,
oh, how would that be? How could the district court? So the district court, if it didn't consider the other things, how could we affirm based on the amended complaint in the 2020 action only?
Mr. Lange makes the similar allegation in the 2020 amended complaint that he knew of his personal property claims in March of 2012.
Where in the complaint does he make that allegation?
Your Honor, I should have.
So I know you've cited several things in your brief that you quote him as saying, you know, I know the bank had the property, but then you don't finish the rest of the line, which is, you know, for safekeeping. I mean, he was definitely couching his understanding of why the bank had his property. And if we're doing this under Rule 12, we kind of have to look at that and then say, well, we assume that to be true. Isn't that enough to get him over the hurdle on a Rule 12 motion?
Well, we don't intentionally leave out anything. We're highlighting the assertions that he's making relating to triggering his knowledge in 2012. And
understood.
And
I guess I'm going to ask this because I'm looking now at a few cases on Westlaw, and we have said in a published case, when it is clear a claim would properly have been disposed of by summary judgment, its premature dismissal under Rule 12 is harmless error. So, I mean, I kind of wonder, you know, how much do we have to focus on Rule 12 if parties had noticed that this was a summary judgment in the alternative, parties developed the record, parties briefed it, and we know that the 2018 complaint is part of that record, so it factors in.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. And I was going to get to that point, which is, you know, we're concerned with the correctness of the entry of judgment, not necessarily the correctness of every particular in the order. and this court can sustain on any grounds. And the judgment as entered is what's important, not necessarily every sentence stated or legal reasoning for every sentence.
But, well, you've cited some case law in your brief that says, which is consistent with Rule 12, if a plaintiff makes an assertion in their complaint in support of their claim, it's deemed to be true. It's essentially an admission. So the question I have, and perhaps Mr. Mahoney could address this on rebuttal, is if that is in fact what the law says about a plaintiff's assertions in his petition, that it's deemed to be true, it's an admission. And if we have, you know, admissions in one complaint that are inconsistent with admissions in another complaint, and we're thinking about summary judgment, I mean, why doesn't the rule kick in that you can't avoid summary judgment by, you know, serving a contradictory self-serving affidavit? It seems to me that, you know, I don't know what we do in the context of Rule 12 if we have inconsistent statements within one complaint. I'm not aware of a case that discusses that, but I'll look. But I do know that when we've got inconsistent statements by the claimant in the summary judgment context, we say, you can't do that. You're stuck with what you've said earlier. And we often see that somebody says something in deposition, then later on tries to backtrack or put a spin on it, and that's not enough to avoid summary judgment. And I wonder if that's what's happening here.
Well, yes, Your Honor. And I would add that the court did cite to statements, admissions made in the 2018 case, but keep in mind, Mr. Lang stipulated to have the two cases companioned, and then we had,
and then we had
one joint hearing on dismissal motions on both cases that Mr. Lang's attorney participated in both.
And understood. And can we assume that the 2018 complaint is part of the summary judgment record? I assume if the judge is citing it, somebody, you guys offered that as proof that there's no issue here.
It was asked where he says in the 2020 action about knowing about his claims in 2012. And that is in paragraph 53 of the amended complaint in 2020 action, where he says defendants co-conspirators, including Cross, told Lang in 2012 that the bank had his personal property. So the court was correct. But he goes into further detail in his 2018 action where he says, yeah, I demanded where it would be told. And
can I just ask you to clarify, is the 2018 complaint part of the summary judgment record?
Well, yes, we cited to the admissions in the 2018 action in the motion. We brought a motion for summary judgment in the alternative motion, Rule 12. We brought it combined. Right. The judge took it as a Rule 12 or issued it under a Rule 12.
But what I'm asking, I'll just cut to the chase. Is there a basis for us to say, you know, we don't need to get into, can you look at the complaint? Is it, you know, akin to a contract? Did he agree to this? So it's his own fault. Or can we just say, you know what, if it was harmless error to do this as Rule 12, we can look at it as summary judgment. And it's part of the summary judgment record. We don't need to get into all this other stuff about whether the judge should have looked at it or not. It was properly before the judge in the context of the summary judgment motion that was pending before the court. That's what I'm asking.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But and I just would like to note, you know, that's kind of the, if you look at it, filing the second complaint 2 years after litigation, agreeing to have it companioned, and agreeing to one hearing, and then telling the judge,
not to look at it.
Don't look at what you know, because now that's hearsay. I mean, it really is. I don't know what the appropriate word is, but you know, it's the court said it would defy logic. The district court said for the judge to ignore all these other admissions, especially after Mr. Lang stipulated. So if you look at that kind of procedural tactic used to say, you know, I'm going to do this and I'm going to agree to have it assigned, but then pretend none of this other stuff exists that's been in front of you for 2 years.
I agree. Let me ask you this, though. If we're really going to say, okay, this was a Rule 12 decision, we're going to look at it under Rule 12. Mr. Mahoney has a point. Then you really need a legal basis for the judge to be looking beyond the complaint. And if we get there and say, yes, you could look at the 2018 complaint, the 2020 complaint, we're left with a situation where all of the allegations, which are supposed to assume are true, are maybe contradictory. What do we do with that? I don't see any case law saying, what do you do if a complaint on a Rule 12 motion has contradictory allegations and which could result in a decision that you can't go forward? I mean, do we have any case law on that?
Your Honor, contradictory to allegations in the 2018.
No, I mean, what if we had one complaint and a person said one thing and then 10 paragraphs later said something else and they're contradictory? What do you do with that in a Rule 12 context if you're supposed to assume everything's true?
So contradictory statements in the same pleading?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that, you know, the statement that he knew that he was aware of his personal property claims in 2012 isn't contradicted, I don't think, anywhere. He has said that repeatedly, including in the 2020 amended complaint.
Okay, so you said this paragraph 12 of the 2020 amended complaint, he says he knew of his personal property claims in 2012.
I believe it's paragraph 18. If I said 12, I apologize.
I could have written it down wrong. And yeah. Do you have that, Freddie? Could you read that language?
I'm sorry.
Could you read that language you're citing us to?
Defendants, co-conspirators, including Cross, that's a Landmark employee, told Lang in 2012 that the bank had his personal property. That's what he said. What he did is he filed a complaint, an amended complaint the same day, and took some stuff out of the first one that he knew that he felt he had to take out relating to his knowledge, and kind of reworded it that way.
But if we're stuck with Rule 12, we're stuck with the amended complaint, right? It supersedes the earlier complaint. And he doesn't say, I mean, he knew the bank had his property. That's his point. It's like, for what purpose? Did he know he wasn't getting it back and he needed to initiate some action? So what you're saying is the assertion in 2020 that he knew the bank had his property is an admission that he knew he had a cause of action and he needed to sue.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Two things. One, under Rule 12, the judge properly looked at what was said. If you look at that statement, and this court can root de novo, he's there acknowledging that he was on notice of bank having his personal property. Now, I don't think you wait 7 or 8 years later to then go learn more and say, do you still have my property? But our contention is under Rule 12, if you just look at that operative pleading, the court's ultimate decision was correct.
Okay. However, and the operative pleading being the amended 2020 complaint.
Correct. And in addition, we think he, as we put in our respondent's brief, he failed to adequately plead fraudulent concealment, which isn't a cause of action. It's an equitable tool to hold under. And he talks about all these conspiracies of these other people and Tom Cross telling him things, but there's no allegation that Mr. Bjorklund's ever met Mr. Lang. And I don't, you know, there's a lack of content to that allegation. And then we also believe that because Mr. Lang stipulated to have the companion case, have the case companioned to avoid inconsistent rulings, which is what the chief judge ruled, that the Judge Miller properly looked at the 2018 pleadings, those admissions. So we believe it's proper under just Rule 12 under the 2020 amended complaint. But we also think it was proper for the judge to consider the other 2018 pleadings because Mr. Lang stipulated to have the cases companioned and took additional steps that had the motions heard together and one order issued in both cases.
Thank you, Mr. Scott.
Thank you.
Mr. Mahoney, you'll have the last word, sir. You've got to unmute now. So.
Okay, thanks.
There you go.
The argument was made that Mr. Lang stated in his amended complaint, the 2020 operative complaint in Bjorklund, that he admitted that he knew in 2012 that the bank had his property. But you have to read the whole sentence, and the whole sentence continues with these critical words. This is paragraph 53. And that the bank would keep Lang's personal property safe and would give Lang written notice otherwise. The response always is, I don't want to look behind that curtain. Those are the words of the complaint. And you heard the argument that Mr. Lange did not allege he was told by Mr. Bjorklund anything. Paragraph 36 of the amended complaint, the 2020 amended complaint, states, Bjorklund conspired with Bjorklund Companies, that's his company, to defraud Lange by taking Lange's personal property, but telling Lange his personal property would be kept or sold at a public sale. So going back to Judge Larkin's question about, could we consider this, could the court consider this to be a summary judgment motion, take the elements of summary judgment, simply decide it was harmless error? The answer is no. Because the submission that was made for the motion, there are no undisputed facts in that motion. None. Zero. Nothing. There are no facts from which we could respond to a motion for summary judgment.
But there was a motion for summary judgment. What was before the court? I'm looking at the brief you submitted in opposition to summary judgment.
Correct.
So, I mean, obviously, I wouldn't suggest this if there hadn't been notice that that was on the table. But
correct, Judge.
Summary judgment was noticed, briefed, opportunity to develop a record.
Correct, Judge. But if you look at when we receive the papers, we have to be on notice what the undisputed facts are. Summary judgment has to be based upon undisputed facts. Rule 12 is the facts in the complaint are deemed to be undisputed and deemed true. When you look at the record for the motion for summary judgment, there is no presentation that we received of what the so-called undisputed facts were. So there was nothing upon which a record could be based for summary judgment. Two problems. First, the bank used the wrong complaint. So if they had submitted facts, it would have been based upon the wrong complaint. Second, if they had used those facts, it would have been submitted under the 2020 complaint as the undisputed facts. We didn't get any of those. So what we responded was an affidavit from Mr. Lange with my recollection is about 85 paragraphs identifying these are the facts that are in dispute. The court took that record because the bank's reply was, oops, here's the amended complaint. We couldn't respond to the reply because there was, basically it's closed to us. So the argument, the notion, the analysis that the court can look at this, that it should be considered as a summary judgment motion because Mr. Lange knew all the facts under which that were undisputed and were presented and he could respond, cannot be true. It is not true.
Looking at your brief to the district court in response to the motion for Rule 12 and it's entitled Memorandum in Opposition to Defendant's Motion to Dismiss or on the Alternative for Summary Judgment. And you've got a section entitled Disputed Facts.
From me.
Yeah, 7 pages long with 112 alleged disputed facts. I'm not understanding the argument that you didn't understand what they were suggesting was a basis for summary judgment.
Summary judge, what I'm suggesting is there are no undisputed facts. We submit in response that there's a motion for summary judgment. And we all know in responding to a summary judgment, you submit admissible evidence of disputed facts. There are no undisputed facts presented by the moving party. So in order for the court to look at it and say, well, Mahoney, you had reasonable notice of what the facts were against which you're going to respond. No, we didn't.
Mr. Mahoney, may I ask you, maybe there's more on this line of questioning. When, in your view, did the cause of action at issue accrue?
On the Bjorklund claim?
Yep, the case before us.
2019.
And that was triggered by?
Notice to Mr. Lange that Mr. Bjorklund had taken possession of Mr. Lang's personal property and learned that it had been sold, or some of it had been sold.
Okay. Notice given to him by?
He learned it in discovery.
There's
no
other
public
case?
Pardon me, Judge?
He learned it in discovery in the other case.
Yes, the 2018 case, the tried case.
From whom?
From Mr. Bjorklund, I believe. I believe it was from Mr. Bjorklund. We learned in 2018 that in 2012, there had been a what I'll call a private sale, an auction of equipment, which we didn't know about. It was something we learned in response to some papers that had been submitted by the bank. So in answer to Judge Smith's question, it's 2019. And then you learned specifically it was Mr. Bjorklund in 2020. So back to the point about, could this be analyzed under summary judgment? It cannot, because none of the predicates for summary judgment are present. There's no undisputed facts against which we could move. The wrong complaint was used to arrive at the presentation for facts. We knew we would be stuck if we didn't do something in response. So we created and presented disputed facts, which creates, there's no response to those. It's basically Rule 56 motion had to be denied because there's admissible evidence of disputed facts.
Thank you, Mr. Honey.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Scott. The matter is submitted.
Thank you all. Time.